Welcome to the Deep Dives, the show where we unpack the most critical information to help you navigate our complex world and become truly well-informed. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the Mother Jones for July and August 2025 issue. I'm your guide, Sam Jacob.
And I'm your expert for this exploration, Alex Barker. For you, our listener, we've pulled together a pretty substantial stack of their in-depth investigative journalism.
Mm-hmm.
This particular issue, as we'll see, focuses heavily on what Mother Jones provocatively calls a techno-fascist takeover.
That's right. And, you know, this isn't just a collection of articles. It's really a curated, comprehensive, and, well, often unsettling look at how technology, politics, and social issues are not merely intersecting, but actively converging in America today. Our mission for you is to distill the core narratives, uncover the surprising facts, and help you understand the profound implications of these critical topics.
And what's immediately striking, I think, and really sets the tone for this whole deep dive, is how Mother Jones crafts its narrative right from the very first glance. The cover of this issue, designed by Eric Carter, it's incredibly stark. Very impactful.
Yeah.
It prominently features the phrase techno-fascist takeover in bold, almost, you know, confrontational lettering.
And it's not just the words, right? It's the visual language that truly prepares you for what's inside. The source points to Doge Cuts, which is this kind of stylized, often digitally distorted aesthetic for the Dogecoin meme.
Right, that sort of chaotic internet vibe.
Exactly, used here to evoke a sense of chaotic, internet-driven absurdity meeting, well, authoritarian control. And then there are these unsettling references to Elon Musk's Nazi salutes.
Mm-hmm.
So a cover like this isn't just an attention grabber. It's a powerful editorial statement. It tells you immediately this isn't going to be light reading.
No, definitely not.
Instead, it's a deeply curated narrative emphasizing this central alarming theme that, well, it pulses through so many of the pieces inside.
Precisely. And this provocative imagery, the wording, it isn't merely for shock value, you know, it's a deliberate choice. It's designed to immediately draw you into the magazine's specific perspective on the concentration of power and control in 2025.
Mm.
So this visual framing, it really primes us for the deep, sometimes alarming investigations that follow. It shows how the whole aesthetic of modern power can be just as unsettling as its underlying mechanics.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit further, because before we even delve into the specific articles, it's really worth highlighting the caliber of journalism Mother Jones represents. In the To Our Readers section, the CEO Monica Bauerlein and editor-in-chief Clara Jeffrey, they proudly lay out the publication's, well, truly impressive track record.
Yeah, it's quite something.
This is a modestly sized nonprofit newsroom, yet they've been punching so far above their weight that, as the source notes, their trophy closet is overflowing.
And that's really no exaggeration. I mean, this year alone, they were a Pulitzer finalist for explanatory reporting for their groundbreaking project, 40 Acres and a Lie.
Which is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. And they didn't just get nominated, they actually won a National Magazine Award, often called an Ellie, for that very same project.
Right.
To win an Ellie is a major achievement, you know? It's kind of like a Best Picture Award in the film industry, but for magazines.
Okay.
And beyond that, they received general excellence for their overall coverage, which is just a testament to their consistent quality. Then there's Garrison Hayes winning a Webby for Best Creator, The Grab getting 4 Emmy nominations.
Wow.
And their investigations into police practices earned them prestigious DuPont and Polk Awards. I mean, for a nonprofit newsroom of their size, it's a staggering, almost unbelievable list of accolades.
It really makes you wonder how they manage it all. The source emphasizes how their merger with Reveal, their sister radio show, was a real game changer. It allowed them to, quote, dig deeper, tell stories more powerfully, and reach broader audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And 40 Acres and a Lie is just a prime example of that commitment to deep, impactful reporting. This wasn't a quick turnaround piece, was it? It was years in the making.
Years. A complex collaboration with the Center for Public Integrity. And it uncovered this truly shocking historical truth that after the Civil War, many Black families were given legal titles to land,
right,
only to have that land cruelly and systematically taken away from them, often returned to their former enslavers. Just devastating.
That's unbelievable.
And what's particularly innovative about this project, and ironically connects to that techno-fascist theme we'll explore later, is their pioneering use of artificial intelligence.
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, they actually built an AI program specifically designed to probe handwritten Freedmen's Bureau records. These are incredibly fragile, often illegible historical documents.
Right, hard to work with.
Extremely. But this AI made them accessible and searchable for ancestral information. And it wasn't just a single article either. It expanded into a three-part podcast series, 6 in-depth features, a powerful video, and a beautiful print edition.
Wow.
It just demonstrates this commitment, not just to uncovering truth, but to making it accessible to people.
So what does this all mean for us, for you listening? Well, these awards and the sheer scope of their projects, they confirm the unwavering journalistic integrity and profound impact of Mother Jones. In an era saturated with information overload, and let's be honest, often superficial or even misleading reporting, their commitment to deep evidence-based journalism provides a really critical counter-narrative. It underscores the undeniable value of going beyond the headlines, of truly digging for hidden truths.
Which is exactly what we aim to do for you in every deep dive.
Exactly.
And this commitment to comprehensive storytelling, it extends to their contributors too. They often offer a personal lens into the issues they tackle. In the contributor section, Henry Carnell shares a particularly telling insight. He mentions he had to constantly update his piece on LGBTQ+ issues because of the relentless, fresh attacks on science and the LGBTQ+ community happening even as he was writing.
Wow, that really highlights the urgency, doesn't it? The ground is constantly shifting.
It really does. And then Julia Mitreau discusses how her research into Elon Musk's public statements about autistic men revealed this disturbing, blatant thread of misogyny woven into his supposed insights.
It's a powerful reminder of the human element behind these huge societal issues. And then there's James Clapham, the illustrator. He expresses this sort of humorous yet darkly insightful fear that by drawing a Trump-themed sitcom, he might accidentally manifest it into reality.
Ah, right. Be careful what you draw.
Exactly. It's a lighthearted moment, but it subtly points to the increasingly bizarre and unpredictable nature of our political landscape.
Yeah.
These personal insights really foreshadow the specific debates and issues we're about to explore, giving us a vital human connection to the stories.
And beyond the personal, there's also the quantitative context provided in the by the numbers section, which is always interesting.
Right.
For instance, Senator John Fetterman, whose transformation we'll discuss shortly, missed a staggering 144 votes in the last session of Congress.
144, that sounds like a lot.
It is. To put that in perspective, that's about 1 in 5 votes, significantly higher than the median senator who missed only around 22 votes.
Wow.
So this figure immediately raises crucial questions about his effectiveness, his commitment to his duties, his overall presence in the Senate, really.
That's a huge disparity that certainly catches your eye. And another fascinating number, this one from a 2019 survey, 90% of college freshmen identified being very well off financially is one of their top goals.
90%.
Yeah. This statistic provides a broader backdrop for understanding societal values and aspirations, especially when we later discuss wealth concentration, economic policies, and the very concept of success within the framework of this techno-fascist takeover.
Mm-hmm. It shows a cultural shift towards material aspiration that could potentially make certain narratives of progress more appealing to some people.
Right.
So these small glimpses, you know, from the contributors' personal anxieties about the pace of change to the hard data reflecting shifts in political engagement and societal values, they collectively set the stage. They prepare us for the complex human elements and systemic issues that Mother Jones so meticulously dives into.
So, with that essential groundwork laid, let's jump into the Outfront section and grapple with some of America's most pressing challenges. Starting with a powerful and, frankly, pretty concerning story about political transformation and the personal toll it can exact.
Okay.
Our first major story in the Outfront section delves into the dramatic and, well, largely bewildering political transformation of Senator John Fetterman. Abby Vizulis' investigation details this meticulously. He was once celebrated, you remember, as a Bernie Sanders-loving populist, a champion of the working class and progressive ideals.
Yeah, that was his image.
Yet, he has undergone such a significant ideological shift that he's now being openly called Trump's favorite Democrat.
Which is truly a bewildering metamorphosis for many who supported him initially. The article describes the profound impact this has had on his progressive base. They're now left feeling abandoned and, in some cases, you know, betrayed. Many now view him as akin to Joe Manchin, a Democrat who often sides with Republicans, or, even more scathingly, an unprincipled Manchin. The visible public frustration is palpable, perhaps best exemplified by the jag-off chants that have erupted at rallies in Pittsburgh, his home turf.
And for those listening outside Pennsylvania, jagoff in Pittsburghese isn't just a generic insult, right?
No, it's specific. It means jerk. But more deeply, it implies someone who has broken the social contract, someone who has violated unspoken community trust.
That imagery of breaking the social contract really hits home. It underscores a profound sense of disappointment. And his policy shifts are not subtle. They are stark and highly consequential. On immigration, a traditionally progressive issue, he co-sponsored the Laken and Riley Act.
Right.
This is a piece of legislation that, while framed by some as addressing migrant crime, is widely seen by critics as significantly expanding detention powers and potentially criminalizing minor offenses for migrants. It requires detention for individuals accused of theft.
And this is particularly jarring, as the article points out, given his own wife, Giselle, fled violence as an immigrant herself,
yeah,
making his stance seem deeply contradictory to his family's experience.
Beyond immigration, his voting record shows a clear lean towards the right.
Yeah.
He voted to confirm a 2020 election denier to lead a key position in the Department of Justice.
Which, you know, fundamentally undermines the integrity of democratic process.
Absolutely. He also approved a GOP budget that granted the former President Trump unprecedented power to slash spending without congressional oversight. And in a truly striking move, he was the only Senate Democrat to vote for Pam Bondi.
Pam Bondi, yeah.
A figure who had falsely claimed Trump won in 2020. This indicates a consistent pattern of aligning with figures and policies really at odds with traditional Democratic stances.
And his bellicose support for Israel has been particularly divisive and, according to the article, deeply personal.
How so?
Well, it caused a significant rift, not only with his aides, many of whom are progressive, but also with his wife, Giselle, who reportedly confronted him directly about the bombings in Gaza. The article even notes that he accepted a silver beeper memento from Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu.
A silver beeper.
Yeah, a gesture described in the source by critics of Israel as an unmistakable symbol of Israel's brutal aggression.
Wow.
And his extreme stance is chillingly summed up in his quote on Hamas. That kind of an evil has to be destroyed. That's why Atlanta had to burn.
Comparing it to Sherman's march? That's intense.
It's a direct and unsettling parallel, yeah, to General Sherman's devastating march to the sea during the Civil War.
And his inter-party conflict isn't confined to the other side of the aisle either, is it?
Not at all. When Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a prominent progressive voice, publicly called for Democrats to fight harder, Fetterman curtly dismissed her, saying, "We kept our government open. Deal with it." Yeah. This series of actions, as the article highlights, has not only mystified his current colleagues, but has deeply alarmed his former and current aides.
This is where the personal toll comes into play, adding a profound, almost tragic layer of complexity to his political shift. A bombshell profile by Ben Terrace in New York Magazine provided a compelling, albeit disturbing, rationale for his transformation.
Right, the profile about his health struggles.
Exactly. It detailed his struggles with post-stroke clinical depression, which led to what the article describes as alarming symptoms. These included unpredictable outbursts, instances of paranoid delusions where he believed family members were wearing wires, and even reckless driving, including a near-fatal rear-ending of an elderly woman while speeding well over the 70-mile-per-hour limit.
It's a deeply concerning and heartbreaking picture. The Mother Jones article details the quiet departures of numerous senior employees, including multiple communications directors, suggesting a troubled inner circle. Former staff like Rebecca Katz and Annie Wu Henry have spoken out, with Katz reportedly texting colleagues that Fetterman seemed meaner in his disposition. And most chillingly, his chief of staff, Adam Gentleson, sent this long, detailed email to Fetterman's doctor outlining a whole list of alarming behaviors. Conspiratorial thinking, megalomania, high highs and low lows, long, rambling, repetitive, and self-centered monologues, lying.
Wow.
These are not minor issues. They suggest a profound unraveling.
This raises an intensely uncomfortable yet critically important question about accountability, doesn't it? As Tracy Batten, the social worker who organized that jagoff rally in Pittsburgh, eloquently put it, if you have a mental illness, you still have to be accountable for your actions and their consequences.
Right. It's a difficult balance.
The implications here are immense. How do we as a society grapple with the challenges of leadership when deeply personal health struggles profoundly intersect with and perhaps dictate political responsibilities?
Yeah.
And what does it mean for the erosion of trust with constituents when a politician's positions drastically change without clear explanation or a perceived sense of integrity?
Yeah.
It forces us to consider the fragility of public service when a leader is so clearly struggling.
Fetterman's story truly highlights not only these dramatic political shifts, but also touches on deeply personal struggles and the fragility of safety and well-being. And this leads us directly to another critical issue detailed in Mother Jones, the profound fight for transgender youth across America.
Henry Carnell's investigative report zeroes in on how the Trump administration has waged a deliberate and systematic war on transgender kids, using executive orders and direct actions to target their healthcare access and school support. This is an abstract policy. It has immediate, tangible, and often devastating consequences for families nationwide.
The report explains that the profound distress some trans people experience, known as gender dysphoria, can be significantly alleviated by medical treatments like puberty blockers and hormones. Parents describe these interventions as leading to an overnight transformation, bringing profound joy and relief to their children. However, the Trump administration's actions are designed to escalate existing state-level campaigns, legitimizing these efforts through misleading claims of indoctrination and, particularly chillingly, by casting trans women as inherently threatening.
What's truly heartbreaking here is how the article illustrates this political war with deeply personal, intimate stories of families caught in the crossfire. Take Susan and her 15-year-old son, Kai.
Okay.
Kai found incredible joy and success after his medical transition, getting on the honor roll at school and having friends over every day. But this rose-colored glasses world, as his mother describes it, shattered after he saw anti-trans protesters outside the Supreme Court.
Oh, that's awful.
Now, the family is urgently preparing identity documents and even considering moving abroad, a desperate measure, just to ensure his continued safety and access to care.
And then there are Charles and Vanessa. Vanessa, a teenager living in a deeply red southern state that has banned gender-affirming care for minors, lived in fear for her life every day.
Unimaginable.
Her father, Charles, would drive her 10 hours monthly for treatment, a grueling journey, only for the hospital to suddenly cancel appointments due to the new Trump administration orders.
So the rug was pulled out from under them.
Completely. Charles states with this fierce resolve, "We're going to do whatever it takes to keep her safe," and they've made the heartbreaking decision to leave their entire hometown, their community, and move to a safer state.
Jenny and Blake's story also stands out, illustrating that even in supposedly blue states, the threat is real. Blake, a 14-year-old trans boy, struggled with intense dysphoria, which led him to self-isolate. His mother, Jenny, initially hesitated about medical treatment, a common and understandable parental concern. Sure. But she agreed when Blake revealed a heartbreaking detail. He showered with the lights off because he couldn't stand to look at himself.
Oh, wow. That's powerful.
Despite living in Connecticut, a state with protective laws, Jenny now actively fights to maintain his access to testosterone, setting up contingency plans with a pediatrician.
So even with state protection.
Exactly. It shows that even where laws are supportive, hospitals are being forced to weigh federal funding against providing essential care, creating this environment of fear and uncertainty.
The broader implications of this war on identity are severe and widespread. Research by the Trevor Project found that a shocking 90% of LGBTQ youth surveyed reported that recent political rhetoric and actions negatively affected their well-being.
90%.
And even more starkly, nearly half of trans participants considered moving from their current homes due to political climates. The systemic threats are real. Hospitals, even in seemingly protected states like New York and Colorado, are forced to make impossible choices, leading to the cancellation of appointments for gender-affirming care.
But amid this grim systemic threat, the article does highlight a vital source of resilience: these informal support groups among parents of trans children.
Right.
Charles describes these groups as fostering immense solidarity and being understood, the compassion.
That sense of community must be crucial.
It really is. It's a testament to how human connection and community can act as a buffer against overwhelming societal pressure. But it also serves as a stark reminder of the isolation and systemic challenges these families are facing, just trying to provide basic safety and care for their children.
This struggle for safe spaces and basic rights, the fight for identity and care, it continues relentlessly. And it reflects larger systemic challenges that communities grapple with, particularly when it comes to fundamental needs like secure and affordable housing.
Phoenix Stone's powerful story of the Hillside Villa tenants in Los Angeles perfectly illustrates this larger issue. These families found themselves facing immediate rent hikes of over 200% after a 30-year affordable housing covenant expired.
200% overnight.
Essentially, yeah. And this wasn't an accident. It was a direct and devastating consequence of Reagan-era reforms that incentivized private developers with tax credits for capped rents.
Okay.
But crucially, these agreements came with a built-in expiration date.
Ah, so it was a ticking time bomb, basically.
Exactly. Gotcha. What's truly astonishing about this policy design is how it essentially created a deferred crisis. It was like kicking the low-income housing can down the road to a future generation of politicians, and more importantly, to the vulnerable residents themselves.
And the situation in LA is not isolated, right? It's a microcosm of a much larger national crisis.
Definitely. The article highlights a staggering national shortage of 7.1 million affordable housing units.
7.1 million.
And the source warns that over 800,000 homes across the country are slated to lose their rental restrictions in the next decade, meaning millions more could face similar displacement.
The human element at Hillside Villa is incredibly powerful. Monica Ruiz, a long-term resident who had raised 5 children there, describes her steadfast refusal to move, stating simply, "No, we aren't going to move."
Mm-hmm.
The community garden in the courtyard wasn't just a patch of green. It served as a vital gathering space for the diverse immigrant families from Mexico, El Salvador, and Vietnam who called Hillside Villa home.
Right.
So this wasn't just about affordable housing. It was about the profound impact on established communities, social networks, stability.
And their resistance was truly remarkable, a testament to collective power. Faced with eviction, the tenants didn't passively accept their fate. They staged a rent strike, drawing immediate attention by calling Spanish-language TV stations. They held sit-ins outside local officials' offices and organized powerfully with the LA Tenants Union.
And their proposed solution was incredibly unconventional, even audacious. They suggested the city loan itself money to buy Hillside Villa through eminent domain.
Which is where the government can take private property for public use, with compensation.
Right, even if the owner doesn't want to sell. And then they proposed transferring ownership to a land trust to keep rents permanently low.
The challenges they faced in pushing this forward were immense, though, pitting community against powerful financial interests. The housing department initially deemed eminent domain too costly, proposing what the tenants saw as a compromise, but ultimately denounced as a giveaway.
What was the proposed deal?
Giving landlord Tom Botts nearly $15 million for a mere 10-year extension of the affordable housing covenant, while requiring tenants to pay 5 years of back rent.
So, kicking the can again.
Exactly. Even Councilmember Nithya Raman, who was sympathetic, acknowledged that this deal was merely kicking the can further down the road, not solving the core problem.
And broader obstacles loom large, making the Hillside Villa's struggle indicative of a national challenge. The powerful California landlord lobby, for example, spent over $150 million just to shut down a state proposition for expanded rent control.
Wow, that's huge money.
It highlights the immense financial muscle arrayed against tenant protections. And on a national level, the Trump administration axed over $1 billion in federal funding for affordable housing, directly impacting the very programs designed to address this growing crisis.
Despite these formidable hurdles, the article does point to remarkable victories and a burgeoning, nationally resurgent tenant movement.
Oh, good. Some positive news.
Yes. A Hillside Villa tenant actually prevailed in court, forcing landlord Botts to drop eviction cases related to the rent strike. The article spotlights other examples of collective action, too, like the Louisville Tenants Union successfully organizing and Bronx tenants who collectively organized to strip their landlord of building ownership due to neglect.
So tenants are finding ways to fight back.
They are. The powerful image of Hillside Villa residents defiantly burning their eviction notices, declaring, "We love to see it," truly embodies this new wave of tenant power and resilience.
This struggle for housing, as Mother Jones reveals, is much more than just a fight for shelter. It's a fight for community, for stability, and for fundamental human dignity.
Mm.
It showcases the immense power of collective action against systemic policy failures, against the very design of incentives that favor private profit over public good, and against entrenched vested interests.
These on-the-ground struggles reflect larger, often abstract forces at play.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the core unsettling theme of this Mother Jones issue, the techno-fascist takeover.
Okay, so moving now to the very heart of this deep dive, the techno-fascist takeover itself. Tim Murphy's analysis introduces us to a truly alarming concept, the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE.
Spelled lowercase, like the meme.
Exactly. Intentionally styled with the lowercase doge from the meme culture to imbue it with this sense of absurd, decentralized, yet powerfully disruptive force. And this doge is presented not just as a government department, but as the realization of a dream where tech billionaires and authoritarians find common cause to systematically break democracy.
And at the center of this, as the article coyly states, Elon Musk is highlighted as Doge's fearless leader.
What's truly fascinating and deeply disturbing are the ideological underpinnings of this movement. It's rooted in the idea of a merit-based ruling class,
right,
a belief that certain individuals, typically those with technological prowess and immense wealth, are inherently better equipped to govern than democratically elected officials.
This draws direct connections to Peter Thiel's long-standing public skepticism about freedom and democracy being compatible ideals,
mm-hmm,
and his significant financial spending to influence politics towards more authoritarian outcomes.
We also see influences from Curtis Yarvin's Dark Enlightenment, that neo-reactionary philosophical movement advocating for a return to monarchical rule.
Yeah, that's pretty out there.
And Marc Andreessen's fervent techno-optimism and almost religious faith in accelerating technological progress as the sole path to human betterment, often disregarding societal costs. The article even highlights that Musk's own grandfather believed in a technocracy replacing the electoral system.
So these anti-democratic ideas have deep roots in his lineage.
Apparently so.
It sounds less like a policy paper and more like a dystopian novel playing out in real time. And Doge, in practice, is even more chillingly effective. It's not just a department. It's metaphorically described as a chainsaw, a wood chipper, and a way of life, like Buddhism.
Suggesting a pervasive, almost spiritual commitment to dismantling existing structures.
Exactly. Its primary role is to demolish firewalls online and off, meaning not just digital barriers, but institutional and legal separations that traditionally protect government functions and citizen privacy.
Right.
This includes firing or threatening to arrest civil servants seen as obstacles.
The source gives a startling, concrete example. Musk's successful attempt to effectively dismantle USA.
That's the U.S. Agency for International Development, overseeing foreign aid.
Right. His lieutenants, according to the article, simply uncheck those boxes in their digital systems, functionally pausing or deleting life-saving international programs. And this was framed with chilling indifference as pronatalism for me, Doge for thee, revealing a worldview where some populations are prioritized and others are simply disposable.
That's breathtakingly cynical.
The surveillance and control aspects are particularly insidious and alarming. Federal employees reportedly feared that Doge was actively monitoring their typing and using advanced AI to eavesdrop on their conversations.
Creating an atmosphere of pervasive distrust.
Completely. The ultimate stated goal was to break down historically legally separated data silos like Social Security, Medicare, and tax data. Their vision was to create nothing less than a God's eye view of the American populace.
And the purpose.
To enable a systematic purging of the undesired and to achieve a massive, unprecedented reduction of government, stripping away vital public services under the guise of efficiency.
And immigrants, as is often the case, bore a disproportionate brunt of this technological control.
Yes. AI was reportedly used to trawl student data specifically for thought crimes, a concept that feels ripped from an authoritarian playbook.
Mm.
Palantir, the data analytics company co-founded by Peter Thiel, actively assisted in tracking undocumented residents. Even the Social Security Administration, ostensibly a pillar of support, reclassified thousands of individuals as dead to prevent them from collecting benefits, cutting off vital lifelines.
That's cruel.
And acting IC director Todd Lyons' chilling wish for mass deportation logistics summed up this dehumanizing approach. He wanted it to be like Prime, but with human beings.
A truly terrifying vision of efficient, large-scale human removal.
This disturbing vision extends to the very aesthetic of Trump 2.0 politics, which the article describes as a machine learning mashup of Thomas Kincaid's saccharine landscapes, Leni Riefenstahl's propagandistic grandeur, and the militaristic satire of Starship Troopers.
What a combination.
Indeed. The source even mentions grotesque AI-generated videos, such as one showing an ethnically cleansed Gaza with Elon Musk casually eating flatbread.
Oh my God.
The implications of this techno-fascist takeover are profound. It's the emergence of a new feudalism, where a fraught alliance between the former President Trump and powerful tech moguls prioritizes unfettered technological advancement and raw profit over democratic principles and fundamental human welfare. They are even explicitly targeting groups like childless cat ladies and the professional managerial class as the enemy, illustrating how broadly their ideological net is cast.
This relentless drive for control and societal reengineering, as Mother Jones reveals, extends even to the most radical aspiration, creating entirely new societies, seemingly unshackled from existing regulations and democratic norms.
Kira Butler's report on cyber secessionists brings this audacious vision into sharp focus. She meticulously details how prominent Silicon Valley moguls, particularly Balaji Srinivasan, who himself created the network state concept.
Right, I've heard of that.
Alongside Peter Thiel and Mark Andreessen, are not just theorizing, but actively working to establish what they call regulation-free, crypto-based network states. And critically, they're explicitly aiming to acquire physical land to manifest these digital societies into the real world.
The vision is nothing short of audacious, almost messianic. They call it tech Zionism. The core idea is to first form an online nation, complete with its own distinct culture, its own economy, its own unique tax structure, and highly startup-friendly laws, all existing in the digital realm. The audacious premise is that this digital entity would eventually crowdfund immense capital and then begin to gobble up physical territory around the world, amassing enough economic and social power to force recognition from traditional nation-states. Srinivasan himself made the truly audacious claim that it is literally easier to start a new country than to reform the FDA.
Which really encapsulates their profound disdain for existing regulatory structures.
Completely.
And this isn't just theoretical. There are alarming real-world experiments already underway. Prospera, for instance, is a semi-autonomous city established in Honduras, funded in part by none other than Peter Thiel and Mark Andreessen.
Right.
Within Prospera exists Vitalia, a longevity-themed pop-up city, specifically catering to medical tourists seeking to bypass what they view as restrictive FDA regulations. Operating under the almost utopian yet chilling motto, we're here to make death optional.
Make death optional.
Okay.
The article also points to other global projects like Andreessen's California Forever, an ambitious plan to transform Bay Area wine country into an entirely new city.
I remember reading about that.
Afropolitan, aiming to create a digital state rooted in Africa. Crescimiento, which envisions Argentina as a crypto nation. And even Saudi Arabia's immense $8.8 trillion special economic zone, NEOM. It hints at a global trend toward these unregulated enclaves.
Here's where it gets really interesting and, frankly, quite unsettling for American listeners. The Native American angle.
Okay.
At the Roten Conference, a key gathering for these cyber secessionists, the idea of partnering with federally recognized tribes in the U.S. was explicitly discussed as a strategic workaround to bypass existing federal regulations.
Ah, using tribal sovereignty.
Exactly. Joe Lonsdale, a co-founder of Palantir with Thiel, even blithely suggested, we should probably get Elon to help us build the infrastructure for some Indians.
Wow, that casual comment reveals a disturbing transactional view of indigenous sovereignty.
Definitely. And this isn't just talk or suggestion, it's manifesting. A prominent case study is the Catawba Digital Economic Zone, or CDEZ, which was officially launched in 2022 by the Catawba Nation. It positions itself as America's first digital economic zone, designed to allow virtual company registration, particularly for banks, with significantly lower fees, taxes, and far less regulation than traditional states.
And its backers promise unprecedented career and job opportunities and broad economic opportunities for Catawba citizens, including waived registration fees and the potential for higher wages and training.
However, skepticism and concern from within the community, as the article notes, abound. Joseph McKinney, the CEO of CDEZ, is notably not a Catawba citizen and previously advised on controversial special economic zones globally.
That raises flags.
It does. Consultant John Quinterno questions the true benefit to the tribe, seeing it more as a libertarian economic movement, strategically moving in to exploit loopholes without clear, long-term advantages for Catawba Nation itself. Catawba elder Becky Garris learned about CDEZ only after it was approved and expressed a profound disconnect, stating it felt like ghost money. You don't see it.
contrasting it sharply with the tangible benefits and community involvement provided by the tribal casino.
Precisely.
There are also significant environmental concerns, as CDEZ's plans include data centers and crypto mining facilities that might be exempt from vital environmental regulations, potentially polluting tribal lands.
Mm.
The precedent is grim. Prospera backers, for instance, are currently suing Honduras for a colossal $11 billion after their agreement was challenged, showing the immense financial and legal power these ventures wield.
The implications are truly alarming. The potential for these regulation-free zones to erode national sovereignty, exploit vulnerable communities, including indigenous ones, and systematically bypass essential safeguards under the guise of historical justice or innovation.
It reveals a chilling underlying ideology described as winning a gang war for territory against progressives.
This pervasive drive for societal engineering and radical control extends even to the most fundamental aspects of human existence, our families, our very biology, and the education of the next generation.
Kira Butler's report on the pronatalism movement exposes a truly alarming current of thought, the belief that declining birth rates fundamentally threaten civilization itself.
Mm-hmm.
Mother Jones reveals that this movement is often driven by deeply unsettling underlying eugenic and white supremacist ideologies, masquerading as concern for the future.
The report meticulously details two main factions driving this movement, illustrating how seemingly disparate groups find common cause. First, you have the trads, short for traditionalists.
Okay.
These are typically religiously motivated, predominantly Christian nationalists who believe in large families as God's divine will. They often subscribe to the insidious Great Replacement conspiracy theory.
Right, the idea that non-white immigrants are deliberately being brought in to diminish white populations.
Exactly. Key figures here include House Speaker Mike Johnson and Paula Whitecane, former President Trump's spiritual advisor.
Then there are the techies, a faction that approaches pronatalism from a more scientific, almost engineering-like perspective, focusing on maximizing human potential. They're intensely interested in cutting-edge biotechnologies like gene-editing embryos, radically increasing human lifespan, and leveraging advanced AI for education to produce what they see as a superior generation.
And Elon Musk is a central figure here again?
Central, almost cult-like figure here, yeah. As is Peter Thiel, his ideological ally. What's profoundly concerning is how these two seemingly disparate groups, one driven by religious dogma, the other by technocratic ambition, find common cause.
Right.
Particularly gaining significant traction within the Republican Party, forming what the article calls a powerful tech-trad alignment.
And J.D. Vance, a Catholic convert with deep Silicon Valley ties, is highlighted as a potent symbol of this unsettling convergence.
The specifics of their proposals are often shocking. Malcolm and Simone Collins are portrayed as the de facto spokespeople of the movement. Despite their outwardly quirky persona, they're openly starting their own religion, have conceptualized future police, and Simone sometimes provocatively wears Handmaid's Tale attire.
Which is quite a statement.
This eccentric public image often distracts from their truly darker proposals, such as openly discussing gene-editing human embryos and using IVF in vitro fertilization to screen for traits like intelligence and to eliminate predispositions to conditions like depression and schizophrenia.
That raises deeply troubling ethical questions about designer babies and a eugenic future.
Absolutely. And the rhetoric escalates from there. Far-right influencer Jack Posobiec at NatalCon, a pronatalist conference, framed their agenda as nothing less than a war for Western civilization, declaring, chillingly, that natalism is our sword and shield.
Wow.
Elon Musk, echoing this existential urgency, believes that civilization will disappear if birth rates don't change, dramatically calling it humanity is dying.
Mm-hmm.
He himself exemplifies this belief through his prolific fatherhood with at least 14 children and has reportedly even propositioned women to have his babies.
Right.
His financial commitment is also notable, including a $10 million donation to UT Austin's Population Well-Being Initiative, funding research into population growth.
J.D. Vance, too, has been a vocal proponent, stating bluntly, "I want more babies in the United States of America." He openly fanboys over Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban's regressive tax breaks for large families, which are designed to discourage women from pursuing careers.
Right.
Vance's deeply controversial childless cat lady's comments and his proposal for a weighted voting system, where parents would effectively have more votes based on the number of children they have, demonstrate how deeply this eugenic-tinged ideology is attempting to enter mainstream American politics and fundamentally reshape democratic participation.
Other figures within the movement push even more disturbing ideas, starkly revealing its underlying misogynistic and discriminatory elements. Scott Yenor, a professor and director at the Claremont Institute, a prominent conservative think tank, openly argues that feminism undermines traditional family life and that the landmark 1964 Civil Rights Act made it suspect to treat men and women differently.
Effectively advocating for a return to legalized gender discrimination.
Essentially, yes. Charles Haywood, an even more extreme figure who openly aspires to be a warlord, states explicitly that women should not have careers and should be socially stigmatized if they do pursue them.
And the article points out that former President Trump himself has embraced aspects of pronatalism.
Mm-hmm.
He's expressed keen interest in fostering a baby boom and has even identified himself as the fertilization president.
Okay.
His rhetoric about good genes for Americans versus bad genes for immigrants directly connects to discredited race intelligence theories, like those popularized by Charles Murray's controversial book, The Bell Curve.
Mm-hmm.
The Trump administration, the article notes, even mold ideas like awarding a medal for mothers of six or more children, a proposal that draws chilling parallels to similar awards in Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union.
Both regimes that use pronatalist policies for coercive ideological ends. Yeah, that's unsettling.
Barely.
Policy suggestions from these groups are equally alarming, showcasing their radical intent to reshape society. U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, for example, has suggested prioritizing communities with higher marriage and birth rates for federal funding, effectively punishing single individuals or those without children.
Wow.
The Heritage Foundation, another influential conservative think tank, has gone so far as to suggest defunding higher education as a means to boost fertility rates by making higher education less accessible to women.
That seems counterintuitive.
And the Claremont Institute, in a truly aggressive statement, advocates for pro-family programming and even incredibly U-Haul trucks for lefties, signaling a desire for forced ideological cleansing.
But the article also contrasts this aggressive rhetoric with demographic reality. The world population, contrary to their alarmist claims, is still growing, projected to reach 9 billion by 2037.
Right.
While developed nations like the U.S. do face aging populations, there are well-established non-baby solutions to these demographic challenges.
Like hiring older workers, supporting caregivers.
Exactly. Supporting caregivers, improving senior health outcomes. However, pronatalists almost universally reject immigration as a solution. With NatalCon organizer Kevin Dolan, known for his racist and homophobic online posts, contemptuously questioning why immigrants would be willing to support elderly dependents.
And journalistic obstacles are a significant part of this story, too. Kira Butler, the author of the Mother Jones Report, experienced this firsthand.
What happened?
She was banned from NatalCon after Dolan publicly outed her email address and accused her of trying to slander my friends.
Wow. That highlights the insular and aggressive nature of the movement.
It does. The article also points out the stark contrast between the mild-mannered public speeches given by figures like Jonathan Kieberman, who secretly republishes fascist works, and Raw Egg Nationalist, who writes about Aryan features and calls immigration a hostile act compared to their truly extreme, often veiled online rhetoric.
It's a critical reminder for us all to look beyond the curated public persona. The danger of this pronatalist movement, as Mother Jones meticulously unpacks, is its profound push for comprehensive social engineering, often with thinly veiled eugenic undertones. What makes it so concerning is its growing mainstream political traction and its explicit aim to fundamentally redefine societal norms around family, gender, and even the very mechanics of democratic participation.
And this vision for a new kind of society, obviously, demands a new kind of education system to propagate its ideology.
Anna Merlin's report, Remaking Minds, The Next Generation of Education, reveals yet another chilling facet of this unfolding techno-fascist takeover.
Okay.
It details how the dismantling of the Department of Education by Elon Musk's Doge initiative creates unprecedented opportunities for private interests to profit and to fundamentally reshape what was once public education. Musk's philosophy here is explicitly stated with a stark simplicity. He believes you want education to be as close to a video game as possible.
As close to a video game? All right. This is where we see the aggressive rise of artificial intelligence in education. The article highlights Synthesis Tutor, a program co-founded by Joshua Don and Crispin Frank.
Mm-hmm.
This is pitched not just as an aid, but as an AI-driven superhuman tutoring program that explicitly aims to replace entire functions of the teacher and ultimately supplant human educators altogether.
Replace the teacher.
That's the aim. Frank's controversial view on the role of educators is striking. He bluntly states, the vast majority of teachers are glorified babysitters.
Oh, that's an unmistakably elitist and dismissive vision of the teaching profession.
Frank himself describes his work as unapologetically elitist, designed with a clear purpose for kids that we think are most likely to have a high impact on society. His chilling, almost apocalyptic declaration is, sorry, it's AI tutors or the slow death of civilization.
So it's presented as an existential choice.
Exactly. This isn't about supplementing. It's about a radical, almost revolutionary intent to dismantle the existing public education system and replace it with something entirely new, driven by specific ideological goals and technological solutions.
Musk's own educational legacy is integral to understanding this vision. Joshua Dawn, the co-founder of Synthesis Tutor, originally founded Astronova,
right,
an online experimental program for 10, 14-year-olds.
Yeah.
This program was rooted in the original Ad Astra school that Dawn launched specifically for Musk's own children and the children of SpaceX employees.
Okay.
The stated goal for Astronova was to teach kids how to solve complex real-world problems, much like Musk himself approaches challenges, aiming to create a new generation of problem solvers aligned with his ethos of disruption and technological solutions.
The curriculum at Astronova, accessible through what they call conundrums on YouTube and Class Dojo, is particularly revealing.
How so?
These educational scenarios often deliberately sidestep complex legal or ethical issues, presenting them as mere puzzles to be solved. For instance, they might explore the morality of a rigged arcade game or ponder an AI-powered politician acting as a puppet of an algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Another scenario discusses how to conceal an AI movie to avoid being legally attacked and banned.
These examples, while presented as intellectual challenges, subtly normalize or circumvent critical thinking about ethical responsibilities, transparency, and societal implications.
Yeah, it seems like they're training kids to find workarounds rather than confront the ethics.
Musk's broader support for school choice is also highlighted as a means to achieve his vision. He frames it as a benevolent way to funnel tax dollars directly to private schools like Ad Astra,
mm-hmm.
arguing that if kids only have one school option and it's bad, then it's like they never had a chance.
The implications of this pervasive push to privatize and AIize education are profound. It risks leading to an unapologetically elitist system that prioritizes a select few high-impact children and potentially undermines the very foundations of critical thinking about ethics and broader societal issues for the majority. Frank's stated goal is not to improve public schools, but to destroy, or at the very least, fundamentally alter them.
The impacts of these radical shifts are not confined to social structures and education, though. They extend profoundly to our environment and economy.
Yeah, affecting areas as critical as climate research and the very stability of our agricultural system.
Henry Carnell's report on the chilling effect on science details in stark terms how the Trump administration's assault on science is directly jeopardizing critical polar ice research.
Mm-hmm.
At the National Science Foundation, or NSF, Ice Core facility in Colorado, there exists a veritable treasure trove of climate information, over 13 miles of meticulously preserved ice cores collected from Antarctica, Greenland, and North America.
These ice cores are truly like a scientific time travel mechanism. Encased within them are ancient air bubbles that provide invaluable data on prehistoric temperatures, weather patterns, atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations.
Data that's absolutely crucial for accurately tracking historical and current climate change trends.
Right. The article notes findings like CO2 levels increasing 10 times faster today than at any point in the last 50,000 years.
Which is a truly alarming rate.
Absolutely. Researchers like Benjamin Riddell Young and Ed Brook use this data to link past wildfire activity during the last ice age to greenhouse gases, which critically helps calibrate climate models that we use for the future, including understanding and predicting current events like the devastating Los Angeles fires.
The urgency of this irreplaceable research is intensified by two major interconnected threats. Firstly, there's the physical threat.
Yeah.
The historical record encased in the ice is quite literally melting due to warming global temperatures.
Oh, no.
Researchers are already finding water alarmingly closer to the surface than ever before.
So time is running out, literally.
Literally. Secondly, there's the insidious political threat. The Trump administration's actions include firing 10% of NSF staff, specifically targeting Antarctica specialists.
Mm-hmm. This led to a climate of fear where researchers felt compelled to remove the phrase climate change from their grant proposals just to get funding.
Just to get funding. Wow.
They also proposed a staggering 25% budget slash for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, a vital agency that provides everything from weather forecasts to climate data jeopardizing critical collaborations with universities.
Beyond domestic policy, the geopolitical impact has been severe, too.
Yeah, the article points to Trump's aggressive stance towards Greenland and Canada, as well as international tensions like the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, which cut off access to crucial Russian Arctic research sections. Mm-hmm. All of this imperils what is known as science diplomacy, that international cooperation vital for global scientific efforts.
This creates tangible fears not only of losing America's competitive edge in science, but also the irreversible loss of historical data.
Meaning questions that we don't know we should be asking yet might forever go unanswered,
yeah,
leaving future generations without critical information to address their own climate crises.
There is, however, a glimmer of global response mentioned. The Ice Memory Foundation, a collaborative effort involving France, Italy, and Switzerland,
okay,
is working to collect and store endangered ice cores in the Antarctic Plateau as a backup. It's a poignant act of preserving knowledge against both the existential environmental threat and the immediate political one.
It's good someone is doing that. But just as science is under assault, so too are the livelihoods of those who feed the nation.
Right. Teresa Katsirilis's report on agricultural erosion details how the Trump administration's actions are systematically sending small and new farmers into a tailspin,
disproportionately harming them and profoundly threatening the fabric of rural economies across America.
The policy impacts have been immediate and devastating for these vulnerable farmers. One of the most direct blows was the freezing of projects funded by the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA.
The big climate and health bill.
Exactly. This directly affected programs like the Rural Energy for America program, or REAP, which provides vital grants and loans to farmers specifically for investments in renewable energy and energy efficiency.
And Laura Beth Resnick's deeply personal story illustrates this human cost. She lost $36,000 from a frozen REAP grant, leading her to state that her trust in government had been irrevocably broken.
That's not just a financial setback. It's a profound loss of faith.
Then there are the deep and sweeping cuts to the United States Department of Agriculture, or USDA, described by DOGE as among the deepest cuts to federal agencies.
Mm-hmm.
This includes the suspension of billions in payments that farmers rely on, a drastic cut of $420 million for food banks, a critical lifeline for struggling communities, and the gutting of regional USDA offices, which serve as a vital lifeline for farm country, providing essential support and resources.
And it's interconnected, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cuts to NOAA staff impact the accuracy and timeliness of weather forecasts, which are absolutely crucial for farmers planting and harvesting.
Yeah. And Bureau of Reclamation cuts threaten the very operation of Western water systems, reservoirs, dams, and canals, which are essential for irrigation in arid regions.
And we cannot overlook the significant damage caused by trade wars. The Trump administration's tariffs on top export markets like China and Canada led directly to crippling retaliatory tariffs.
125% from China, 25% from Canada, further burdening American farmers who rely heavily on international sales.
What's crucial here is understanding the disproportionate harm. Small and newer farms, often those aligned with climate reform, food security, and racial equity initiatives, are far more vulnerable than large family and corporate farms.
Mm.
They don't have a plan B or generational wealth to rely on to weather such storms.
Unlike massive commodity growers who might benefit from bailouts, like Trump's substantial $28 billion first-term bailout, which primarily went to large agricultural corporations,
right,
the socioeconomic implications of these policies are dire and far-reaching. The risk of small farms going belly up makes their land ripe for the taking by larger, often corporate operations, thereby accelerating the already troubling trend of wealth and land concentration in agriculture.
Mm.
This trend further hollows out rural economies because big growers tend to buy from multinational corporations rather than local purveyors, leading to fewer people in the town, fewer kids in school, fewer small businesses that once formed the backbone of these communities.
And here's the profound irony, almost a tragic contradiction, highlighted by the article. Rural communities, despite being fiercely loyal Trump supporters,
yeah,
with nearly 78% of voters in farm-dependent counties casting their ballot for him in 2024, are among the hardest hit by these very policies.
So they're voting against their own economic interests, in a way.
It appears so, according to this analysis. Kevin Leavitt, an organic farmer in Maine, put it starkly, saying the administration's actions would seem like they're trying to create fewer farms.
That demonstrates the severe, tangible consequences of ideological disruption on the very livelihoods of those who support the policies.
These policies, intended perhaps to streamline government and assert ideological control, are instead accelerating rural decline, concentrating wealth, and centralizing land ownership.
It's a vivid illustration of the severe, often unintended consequences of radical ideological shifts colliding with the tangible realities of people's lives and livelihoods.
So we've just navigated a truly complex and often unsettling tapestry woven by Mother Jones in their July and August 2025 issue. This deep dive has meticulously exposed the intertwining threads of technocratic power, social engineering with its eugenic undertones, the erosion of democratic norms, and the very tangible human impact these shifts are having on individuals, families, and vital sectors like science and agriculture. It's clear that these seemingly disparate topics are in fact interconnected, revealing a cohesive, overarching narrative of radical change and immense challenge unfolding across America.
And when you're confronted with such deep dives into the intricate mechanisms of power, you know, from the audacious visions of digital fiefdoms seeking to build regulation-free societies on acquired land, to the nuanced human struggles of mental health intersecting with political office, what responsibility does this comprehensive knowledge impart upon you?
Yeah.
How might understanding these complex dynamics shape your own engagement with information, your community, and the choices you make about the future you want to see?
That's a powerful question to consider, and one we hope you'll continue to reflect on. We encourage you to keep seeking comprehensive, detailed information and engaging with the critical questions raised by such essential, in-depth reporting.